Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness.
This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Daly will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the net to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it, so what?
This is a
police
joke.
In riot gear with truncheons. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
The recognition of Guaido,
unelected gobshite, is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite,
and
I would reprimand you over that.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of I Foresee Trouble. We're in Strasbourg this week and it's been sort of a strange plenary. Claire's been calling it the plenary that wasn't. There's lots of missed opportunities to speak about really relevant stuff that's going on. There were some tetchy debates about Ukraine and sending arms.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in an overall sense, we sort of pride ourselves in being amongst the most prolific speakers in the plenary. It's something we take very seriously and we hang around for a lot of the debates, but there's something odd afoot this time round in that the catch the eye procedure, which is a mechanism whereby you can get in on the discussion even if your group doesn't give you time, and normally that's where we get most of our speaking time, but it was restricted for us on a whole number of key debates. There were a whole number of ones as well, and we didn't get our 1 minute speech either, which is a topic you can pick for yourself. It goes into a lot. It's the last item on a Monday evening. They take about 30 MEPs. It's normally about that many. But that's the third time now I haven't got that, which I find a bit peculiar. So we were wondering, are we being selected? Are we being trying to be silenced? But we'll know that further, I suppose. But the Israel one was interesting, I suppose. And there was interest and ramifications from it, because after that, the remarks of Joseph Borrell, the High Representative, the Israelis weren't too happy about that. I saw you commenting on that on social media, Mick. So,
yeah, well, I suppose, first of all, to deal with your first point, we probably are the two highest speakers most of the time out of the 705 in the plenary. And it was unusual this week in that we, well, from our perspective, we've kind of denied six speaking slots, which hasn't happened before. I've never failed to get the 1 minute speech before. Okay, fine. Maybe they did have their full allocation. I don't know. The five catch the eyes that I didn't get, where I sat through the debate from start to finish. And I've only missed one. There's only one occasion in the last 12 months where I didn't get catch the eye. So that's a bit unusual. And they were mostly topics that were controversial. And it was like, maybe we're getting too much oxygen. Maybe we're wrong. Listen, I don't know. But it's really peculiar. And the nature of it, of the manner in which, no, we're not doing this, you're not doing that, you can't get this, you can't get that. It was different, right? And about a year ago, there was a genuine acknowledgement in the Parliament that there wasn't enough people participating in lively debate in the plenary. Now, obviously, that's also true of committees. But what they took a more positive approach to catch the eye, which people who don't get speaking time from their group can put in for HDI, and they generally would get it provided they sit through the debate. And that definitely made for a livelier plenary. You had a whole lot of extra people in waiting to get a chance to speak at the end. And so you had more engagement. And engagement has to be good for any political process, no matter what position you're taking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the one we were really sort of, Israel was a point in kind. We felt that was maybe political, because we were going to absolutely lash into it. I mean, the discussion was about deteriorating democracy in Israel. Our first point on that would have been, well, for something to deteriorate, it'd have to exist in the first place. And there isn't much democracy in Israel if you are a Palestinian, and bringing those points to the fore. Now, a lot of the MEPs were concentrating on the protests in Israel itself against the new government. Borrell, the High Representative, made a sort of a, what I would call a wishy-washy speech, where he did give out the Israelis for the violence, but also kind of blamed the Palestinians instead as well. And laughably, following that, the Israeli government announced that they were withdrawing their invitation for him to attend, to go and visit Israel, because they didn't like what he had to say. Now, this is our supposed like-minded partner, where we give favourable treatment to. The High Representative of the Union makes a, you know, a little bit of an acknowledgement to Israeli violence, and suddenly he gets cancelled. I mean, my God, I don't know what they would have done to us, because we would have definitely concentrated on the apartheid nature of Israel, which we discussed last week on the podcast. But it is a legal definition, and the discrimination of Palestinians absolutely reaches that threshold. I was raging as well, because I got a present of a Bohemians football jersey. I had my jersey on. Bohemians stands with Palestine, obviously, and we were going to make a stand with them and with Jeremy Corbyn, indeed, who got slated by the Irish media for wearing the Bo's jersey. So I had my jersey on and all, and I couldn't even get my moment of glory in that. So doubly annoyed.
Yeah, I mean, people should know that in December last, just a couple of months ago, 28th of December, in fact, Netanyahu, who is the Prime Minister of Israel, he said, "The Jewish people have an exclusive and unquestionable right to all areas of the land of Israel. The government will promote and develop settlement in all parts of the land of Israel, in the Galilee, the Negev, the Golan, Judea and Samaria." Now, so in other words, these are all lands that are also occupied by Palestinians. And so they're boasting about the fact that they're creating a Zionist state. I mean, they want a Jewish ethno-state. They're shouting from the rooftops that they don't give a damn about democracy, and that apartheid hardly goes far enough for them. So while many of the MEPs were saying, "Oh, Israel, you must remain democratic. You're the only democratic country in the place." Well, that's absolutely bollocks, obviously. Israel hasn't been a democracy in our lifetime. But they were concentrating on the fact that they're bringing in a law as well, which they're threatening to bring in the death penalty for Palestinians who misbehave. And obviously the EU is upset by that because we oppose the death penalty, and rightly so. But I mean, the idea that we should have a debate discussing the deterioration of democracy in Israel when there was never democracy in Israel, the Palestinians have no vote in how their society has been organised. And we were probably eager to point out more than anything that Israel has just run amok since Christmas. Last year, 155 Palestinians were killed, murdered by the Palestinians, by the Israeli state. And it was a record since outside of a wartime, since 2005. This year, they've already killed over 80 Palestinians, civilians. It is absolutely crazy. And the truth of the matter is that Israel is drunk on the impunity afforded them by the unconditional Western funding, military and economic and diplomatic support. We have spoiled them rotten. And as Claire pointed out, the response to Borrell, who put in some mild criticism of the fact that loads of Palestinians have been killed, even though he didn't actually go strong on it, they withdrew his invitation. I mean, in all fairness, what planet are the EU living on that they take this from this lawless state who have no respect for international law, no respect for the human rights of Palestinians, and yet they're considered our like-minded partners. We have an association agreement with them that they refuse to break. We love to give out about countries like Syria and Iran, things that go on there, but we dare not challenge the apartheid state of Israel.
It was real annoying because another one of our like-minded partners that we didn't get a chance to question was Ursula von der Leyen, who reported back from her meeting with Biden. And I wanted to ask her about, well, whether she had raised the issue of the bombing of Nord Stream 2, the biggest attack on European infrastructure, considering that we always waffle on about foreign interference and attacks on the EU. I mean, there are lads in here who call migration an attack on the EU, or Chinese investment an attack on the EU. Here we have an actual attack on the EU, and Ursula goes and meets Biden, who a very credible source, Seymour Hirst, says might have signed off on the nod to detonate those explosives in conjunction with Norway. And has the EU asked anything about that? No, they haven't. And into the vacuum then we see the US coming out now, where US intelligence reports that actually no, it might have been some Ukrainian non-state actors. Clearly these are the people who brought us the weapons of mass destruction, so we won't be believing too much now from the US intelligence. But the fact that they felt they had to go onto the front page of the New York Times to say, oh, it wasn't me, kind of tells you something. And the very fact that Ursula and the gang aren't asking is pretty regrettable. So I was raging that I didn't get the chance to ask that to her face or in my 1 minute speech either. But let them take note, these questions are going to continue being asked and the truth will out on this, because more and more people now are putting the spotlight on it.
I still remember being at a gig for Environment the evening after the attack on Nord Stream, and there were several Greens on it, and they were openly saying, well, the Russians did it. And I thought to myself, where are these people coming from? What evidence do they have? Why would the Russians blow up their own pipe? If they don't want the gas to flow through it, why don't they just turn off the tap on their end? It'd be an awful lot easier than blowing up a pipe that's going to cost over $1 billion to fix, which obviously that was also owned by the Germans and the Dutch, and I think the Swiss have a share in it. And we have nothing to say about it. We're not looking for any investigation. And Biden was standing beside Schultz last year when Biden said, if Russia invades Ukraine any further, we will put an end to Nord Stream 2. And Schultz, the German Chancellor, who owned some of the German state, owned a big section of the pipeline with Russia and the Dutch and the Swiss. And Schultz is standing there and saying nothing. The pipe is blown up. A very reputable journalist called Seymour Hirst says that the Americans did it and that Biden authorised it. We don't know for sure because there hasn't been a proper investigation. The Swedes done some investigating, but they couldn't tell us what they found. Obviously, the information wasn't fit for our ears. And the Swedes don't want to know either, even though it was right close to them. The Danes don't want to know, and it was right close to them. Very unusual that a major terrorist attack so close to their shores happened, and they don't want to know the truth. This is an absolute disgrace. This brings absolute shame on the European Union. It makes the European Union seem such a weak entity. We have really gone down a slippery slope.
Well, that's why we had some crack on Monday night then, when they brought in their review of the European External Action Services, which was anchored in a debate called The EU, A Stronger Presence in the World, which was just a hoot. And we actually got a good laugh out of that, like when most of the world's countries have rightly noted the servility which Mick has highlighted in the antics of the like of Schultz and other European leaders. Like, these have bent the knee to US empire, and the idea that they're carving out a stronger position in the world when actually they're weaker than they ever are is a bit pathetic.
And Schultz was in New York, or was in Washington a couple of weeks ago as well. He went to see Biden. No press were allowed to attend. The whole thing was done in secret. No press conference afterwards. So the press wouldn't get a chance to ask Biden, ask Schultz, did he ask Biden, well, did he just do it or not? Who did it? I mean, Schultz goes over, he comes back, and he doesn't tell us, oh, well, the Americans said they didn't do it, or he didn't say the Americans said they did it. He's nothing to say about it. Now, come on. I mean, kids in a national school have worked that one out. It's just too bad.
I think one of the other things they're under severe pressure on is the idea of a ratcheting up the military support for Ukraine. And that was another issue that they got onto the agenda late in the day, that we need to fast track our military support for Ukraine. And that was actually really heated debate. Actually, Mairead McGuinness took the questions for the commission, and she even said to us afterwards, my God, that got very heated, because some of our German colleagues, the green German warmongers in particular, were having none of it. These big, heavy armchair generals won't get enough of it until every single Ukrainian man has been served up to the meat grinder. But I'm actually getting really seriously sick of these individuals sitting in here in their comfort and ignoring the reality on the ground for ordinary Ukrainians. Ukrainian men, there's talk of them being forcibly rounded up. There's talk of desertions. The attrition rate is severe in terms of the carnage. These are real men with families, with mothers, with fathers, with wives, with children. And there's no coming back for them. And the lads in here can't get enough. And they get up and say, but they are fighting for our values. Lovely. Did you ask their wives or their children that that's what they were doing? Or even them? Mm-hmm. It's appalling. But that was quite heated, wasn't it, Mick?
Oh, listen, it was too bad. And we did get in on Catch the Eye on that. And we were attacked from all over, from different angles. It was just mad stuff altogether. But I mean, we have MEPs now telling us that pouring more and more arms into Ukraine is going to bring peace. Mm-hmm. Now, well, first of all, there's a couple of thousand probably dying every week with this approach. And it's poor Ukrainians and poor Russians that are doing the dying. Putin's fucking friends are not doing the dying. The MEPs are not dying in it. And there's the rich in Ukraine are not dying in it. This is we're literally throwing people into a machine. Like, it's like just throwing them under the tanks. It's like a slaughter. I mean, this doesn't make any sense. And when I got the chance to speak, I made the point that when the Brits put armored cars, tanks, and guns onto the streets of Derry and Belfast, it didn't bring peace. Like, it brought absolute misery. And it was hell on earth for the people of those cities with the presence of the British army there at the time. And pouring arms into Ukraine now makes no sense. And their one argument to back it up is that, oh, but we're going to win this war. The only way this war can end is with a Ukrainian victory, right? Well, Ukraine are not going to win the war. Neither are Russia. No one's going to win this war. There's no going to be no winners. Everybody's going to lose, except NATO and the US military-industrial complex, and an element of the military-industrial complex in Europe as well. But I pointed out that there was a recent Munich Security Conference. And the countries in the global south weren't buying the European warmongering. And one in particular who spoke very well was the Prime Minister of Namibia. And when she was asked why Namibia abstained at the United Nations on the vote regarding the war, she said, "Our focus is on resolving the problem, not on shifting blame." And she said, "The money used to buy weapons," she said, "could be better utilised to promote developments in Ukraine, Africa, Asia, and other places, in Europe itself," she said, "where many people are experiencing hardships." Now, what is that's not rocket science. But the truth is, we have spent hundreds of years lecturing the poor countries of the global south, telling them what civilization was, how you should behave, how you should live. Well, you know what now? It's gone around a bit. And it's about time we start taking some advice from them. And we should listen to the people from the global south who are talking common sense while we are warmongering and promoting an absolutely crazy cause.
Well, I thought it was interesting that you made the point about the British troops on the streets of Derry, because this was one thing. One little German fella who followed us into the lift near, I think we followed him into the lift actually, and he was going on, Oh, well, you know, if you were in Ireland, Ireland would never be free kind of thing if you had that attitude that you have to Ukraine, which is the complete opposite. I'm sorry, Michael, didn't realise, were you actually in favour of arming the IRA? I didn't see any of you or your party actually advocating that. And the reason why Ireland eventually, the Brits withdrew was as a result of a peace agreement, which in actual fact, fair play to the US, they played their role in that as well. But the cheek in them trying to sort of conflate the struggle for Irish independence with the defence of Ukraine, they are not the same issue at all. And we've never said that Ukraine doesn't have a right to defend itself. Of course it does, absolutely, in international law. The issue that we're debating is what is the response of the international community. And the international community inflaming and escalating that conflict is not helping. They should be doing everything they can to de-escalate and bring about peace. Two interesting things about that debate, which I thought were a bit different. One, the warmongers were a bit more agitated. They were definitely shouting and roaring a lot more. I know they sometimes do, but they were doing it in a really narky way, which says to me that we were kind of hitting close to the bone. The second thing which was interesting was a number of speakers from the Social Democratic group, which, as we've said before, are kind of mainstream Labour Party equivalent types. But some of their Eastern European members over the past period have definitely been shifting. I noticed it with the Bulgarians first, that they began to be, if you like, sitting on the fence. Now, in the early days of the first resolution a year ago, some of their members said to us that they actually would have loved to have voted with us, but they were afraid of the backlash. Mm-hmm. But suddenly, 6 months in, they were beginning to talk a bit more about peace, but in a kind of a cagey way. But this week they were out of the traps. They were staunchly defending the need for peace and the lunacy of war. And actually there were some Slovakians as well who come into the fray from the Social Democratic group, also interestingly coming out on that. So I thought that was interesting. Another little aside, when our colleague Stelios Kalouglou from Syriza in Greece got up today and sort of reminded the chamber that it was the 20th anniversary of the war in Iraq and how we had appropriately condemned Putin's war crimes, that it might be now time to bring Bush and Blair to account for their war crimes. And he was actually booed by the House, the other sides of the House from the Renew and EPP group.
I mean, I couldn't help looking around, even in the chairs close to us, about see who was clapping and who wasn't. It's scary that the Americans illegally, with a lot of support of the European countries and the NATO countries, went into Iraq illegally. They reckon there was close to 1 million civilians killed. Not people carrying guns, civilians killed in Iraq. It was incredibly brutal. And we had nothing to say about it. What's gone on in Ukraine is terrible. They reckon there's somewhere between 8 and 20,000 civilians killed, which is terrible. And the numbers of soldiers far greater. We rightly condemn the invasion of Ukraine. How, in God's name, can we turn a blind eye to a war that was 100 times worse?
Yeah, especially now, 20 years later, with all the benefit of hindsight.
On the anniversary. They don't want to know about it. They don't want to know about the war in Yemen today, where 400,000 civilians are dead. 400,000, according to the UN. And 16 million are hungry. And this is a war that's orchestrated by the US, the UK and France, namely, with Saudi and UAE on the front line for them, a terrible illegal war as well. It's just horrific.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the topic of, I suppose, the Middle East and EU geopolitical interests and enemies and supposed enemies of the EU in the Middle East, there's been renewed discussion about Iran. Particularly that really horrific case of all these schoolgirls who have been poisoned. It's very unclear what exactly is happening in that side of the country, but it was on the agenda this week. And it was one of the things you didn't get the opportunity to speak about. So.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is, I suppose, the worrying thing about this is that the European Parliament never, ever, ever stops seizing on anything that happens in Iran to try and spin it for its own purposes. the idea of anybody targeting children and young people in a school environment and jeopardising their health is and possibly even lives, because there's been sort of mixed stories as to, you know, paralysis, temporary paralysis, maybe talk of one person dying, but it's all very unclear and totally reprehensible that children would be used in this way. But the Iranian government have come out. They've launched a multifaceted investigation into it. They've said, and they have to be transparent in the findings in that. But you'd want to hear the parliament getting up as if they were there. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson were strongly afoot that they, in the one breath, said, well, we don't really know who happened, but we really do. We do. It's the government of Iran. It's the government of Iran. Now, what possible purpose the government of Iran would have been doing in poisoning children in its own schools is a bit ridiculous. I mean, these aren't the Taliban. They're very proud of educating women and girls. And while we may not like, and if I was in Iran, I'd be certainly championing the idea of not having to wear the hijab or that type of thing. But it's I found it sickening on a couple of fronts. It was terrible that the European Parliament is jumping to conclusions and stirring the pot, because by doing that, we're undermining the very people we claim that we want to support, the people struggling for human rights and decent living standards in Iran. We're supposed to be on their side. So why would we do anything to sort of jeopardise that? And that's what we're doing. And then the double speak of that, that we're whinging about them, oh, possibly being the victims of a chemical attack, and oh, it's terrible, their health is impacted upon, when we're implementing sanctions which have killed young women, have killed people for lack of healthcare. So sorry, lads, double standards again, you know. Of course, there should be a transparent investigation. But again, very unhelpful intervention by the Parliament. Very unhelpful.
Yeah, I mean, you had all these MEPs presuming Iranian state guilt for causing children to be poisoned in Iranian schools. Now, this is obviously a terrible episode for the children involved, for the schools, and they still don't know exactly what's happened. But they are very keen, obviously, to find out what's going on, who's responsible, and to hold them to account.
It seems that they're not even completely clear that it's definitely poisoning. It's just really...
There's an awful lot of sides to it. And I was trying to find out, had anybody died, right? Mm-hmm. And there's talks that a 12-year-old may have died from that, but it's not certain. And here we are, having a resolution in the European Parliament talking about something that we know nothing about. We have no evidence. We're not prepared to wait for things to be investigated properly. We're not prepared to wait for the real evidence to arrive. We want to talk about it. And why is that? Why did we have that resolution this week? I mean, I can't help thinking it was just another opportunity to kick Iran. Now, look at, I've made the point before, if I was living in Iran today, I'd be on the streets protesting too. I'd be looking for a separation of church and state.
And there are really serious things that Iran, you know, it can be rightly called up on.
Absolutely.
And like, there's horrific stuff going on.
Yeah, I mean, look at, I mean, we disagree with the level of influence that the clerics have in the political process. We don't agree with that anywhere in the world, right? And we'd love to see a change in Iran too. And if I was living in Iran, I'd be protesting on the streets about it. But you know what else I'd be protesting about? I'd be protesting about foreign interference. I'd be on the streets as well protesting about that. The Israelis and the Americans have gone to incredible lengths to undermine Iran, to bring about regime change, to make it an attractive venue for their exploration and exploitation, to feed American interest and Israeli interest, right? But I mean, why aren't we talking about that? Now, I mean, also, right, if we're so goddamn concerned, as Claire said, the sanctions are killing people. The sanctions, has it dawned on the MEPs that the sanctions that they are looking for to be increased every second day are killing women and children in Iran every day? There's horrific sanctions on Iran. They're illegal. It is madness. We shouldn't be doing, if we cared about the people of Iran, if we cared about the women of Iran, we wouldn't have sanctions on the Iranian state. And it, as Claire said, it once again, it exposes the terrible hypocrisy that that is so much part of the European Union.
Well, I mean, when you think about it as well, going back to Nord Stream, I mean, we think there should be an investigation in Iran. They should make the findings public and all that. But this has only happened and the information isn't clear. Nord Stream 2 was over 6 months old.
And
we're calling
here
for an... it's our infrastructure. And we're calling for an independent, transparent investigation into that. And there hasn't been a single resolution in the Parliament. There, we have tried to introduce it. Hasn't got on the agenda. We couldn't even do our 1 minute speech on it. Double standards or what?
Like, oh, stop. I mean, we were here till 11:30 last night. We were here till 8:30 on Tuesday night. We were here till, I think it was 10:30 on Monday night. And not to get in on Iran last night, it was just soul destroying not to get the opportunity to speak after we're sitting through all the debate, right? And one of the things as well that we were once again going to bring up is we were going to call on the Iranian authorities to release the Irish citizen Bernard Phelan on humanitarian grounds. We think Iran should release him. And we really hope that the Iranian authorities come around to seeing that this is the right thing to do.
So I think we're going to wrap it up on that note. The end of a strange Strasbourg, but I suppose lots of...
Keep you posted.
Exactly. Watching out for censorship and silencing all around. So until next time.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Bye-bye.